Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. We started Audio Open Lines on the other side of the break, and we're continuing it now for the next hour of the program. We've got a long ways to go. We're still not even done with the roundtable on the role of religion in America. I think I would always be too frustrated to even sit at one of these panel discussions. And it's not because I wouldn't have anything to say, and it's not because I disagree profoundly with any one of the panelists there. It would be because threading the needle on this issue is so hard. Now, you've already heard two extremes. One is an Episcopalian woman in the panel saying, look, we ought to have safeguards to keep religion personal, private. Yeah, you'll carry it into the public square, but for the most part, keep it private. On the other hand, which is impossible, not even an atheist with their religious views, and atheists do hold a religious view. If you say, I believe in no God, you have made a statement of a religious nature. It may be the only statement you're willing to make, but you've made a statement of a religious nature, even the denial of the existence of God. A thoroughgoing atheist wouldn't call himself an atheist. He would just call himself by his proper name. The other extreme that we've heard is the evangelical woman saying, look, they're trying to cut religion out of society. There's a movement to ban religion from public life. There might appear to be a movement to some to ban religion from public life. But if that movement had any strength whatsoever, you wouldn't be listening to this program. You wouldn't. You wouldn't be able to turn on the radio or television and see anything of a religious nature. Now, we have unprecedented, even with the taking the Ten Commandments down and the banning of prayer in school, which from my perspective is a better idea than having prayer in school. Even with all of that, we still have unprecedented religious freedom. If there is a movement to take religion out of the public square, it's a pretty measly movement, if you ask me. So, if you were sitting at this panel, what would you add? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's pick up where we left off.
The problem I see with faith is that it takes certain beliefs off the table of conversation.
Give me an example.
Same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. If you believe that same-sex marriage is wrong in your church, then fine, your church should not offer that sacrament. The government should treat all of its citizens the same.
That's the thing. Governments don't treat everyone the same. People are treated differently.
But that's the way our country is set up. No one can impose their set of values on someone else.
You don't want to get married to a woman. Don't. But don't tell me I can't marry a woman if that's what I want to do.
People impose their beliefs on people all the time. You can't get in a car in this city and go any speed you choose. We're going to treat you differently if you do that.
Because you could kill people.
Well, that's right. There's an argument that led to that decision.
Meredith and I getting married is not going to kill anybody.
Don't tell anyone that.
There are all kinds of laws that we have that we make moral choices on.
But see, here's the problem. I just saw the problem. You immediately say you're wrong about that.
This is the problem.
Right, we don't trust each other. We don't believe
each other.
We have a wall here. I mean, how to resolve this in the span of a few minutes?
Honest, lettered people disagree with this issue.
But the problem is you want your values taught.
I want equal treatment. Correct. And what is wrong with that?
And if you want a certain set of values, then create your Christian school and send your children there.
I think there's just a war of ideas we have to wage with ourselves here. And we have to figure out how we are going to live in a 21st century with all of these competing moral communities.
Can we not believe in something very deeply and still like each other and have an open conversation?
I think because our country regulates religion so much and kind of bans it in certain places, that has caused this atmosphere of people not discussing their religions with each other.
We talk at each other, we talk about each other, and so we all feel in some way assaulted because we caricature each other. Rather than hearing the honest reasons why we either embrace faith or don't embrace faith and respecting each other because of it.
And full disclosure, our little chat lasted more than an hour and a half. Our panel found that while talking is important, most of the issues that divided them at the beginning divided them at the end as well.
Big surprise there, huh? I mean, you get an Episcopalian woman from this is arguably the most liberal mainline Protestant denomination ever in history. They're running a close race with the United Churches of Christ. An atheist, an evangelical layman who's written some sort of a book, and what appeared to be just kind of the average evangelical woman, you put them in a room together along with Meredith Vieira, is that her last name, from the Today Show, and you say, let's come to some understanding here. You give them an hour and a half, and they still disagreed in the end. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In the end, they seem to kind of agree on one thing, and that is, well, we don't listen to each other. We don't still like each other, even though we disagree, which to me seemed counterproductive. It kind of, everything that they had talked about up to that point all becomes moot. All the argument becomes moot because it's like, well, we disagree, but let's agree to disagree and still like each other. Look, liking each other is not the issue. Liking each other is beside the point. We should like each other regardless. But there is truth here. That's the one thing I didn't hear in this panel discussion. There's truth, and then there's falsehood. Now, not everyone on the panel was arguing for that, knowingly, intentionally arguing for that, but every single one of them was arguing that what they were saying is true, what the other person was saying was false, even if they didn't want to admit it. Let's talk with Roger, who calls from his car.
Hey, Todd, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Great discussion. I wanted to maybe have you clarify what you said about prayer in school. Now, you know, I think we're pretty much the same on this particular issue, but you said, you know, the ban on prayer in school is something I assume you're in favor of, but I want to clarify that. I mean, you wouldn't ban all prayer in school, so if a child wanted to say grace before lunch in a personal, private manner, that would not be something that you would want to ban, of course. But a school-sponsored prayer where the school itself, you know, sponsors the prayer, perhaps even directs children to pray at a certain time, would be something that you would not be in favor of. Is that correct?
I think you fairly represented my position there, Roger. Where, if at all, would you disagree?
That's exactly where I'm at on the issue. That's why it kind of worried me a little bit when you said that, and I didn't think that that would be something that you would say, look, we shouldn't pray in school. So I just wanted to clarify that and maybe pick your brain a little bit on it, but thank you.
All right, Roger, thank you very much, and thanks for listening. Well, okay, let me explain, because Roger and I agree, but maybe the rest of you don't understand. I don't really care whether there was any kind of a ban on school prayer. If there were moments in the school day, and this is how it's always kind of described, there was this pristine time back in American history when the school marm would stand at the front with her big gigantic ruler and her hair up in a bun, and at the beginning of each day, the children would piously turn toward the American flag, say the Pledge of Allegiance, and then speak words of prayer all together in unison. Now, that might have taken place at a lot of schools. It might have. But I think you're hearkening back to something maybe 100 years ago rather than something 50 years ago. Yes, there was a time when even public schools began the day with prayer. And they shouldn't have. Not because it's religious discrimination, but because the public schools have not been given the authority to do this. Now, the authority doesn't belong to the individual either. The authority actually belongs to the church. If anyone should be calling people to prayer, it's the church. The problem with, say, let's bring prayer back into our schools is, whose prayer do you bring back? You know, there are a lot of evangelicals that if they said, let's bring prayer back to school, and I said, fine, let's bring the Lord's Prayer back to school. That, no, Roman Catholic. We don't want to pray that Roman Catholic prayer. Oh, yeah, it is the Lord's Prayer, but we don't want to pray that. All right? If not that, then what? Any prayer that could possibly pass muster in a public school would be so hopelessly generic as to be meaningless. And to my way of thinking, thoroughly unchristian. Well, it doesn't have to be particularly Christian. Everybody prays to the God they want to. Is that really the situation you want for little Billy or little Sally sitting in the third grade classroom saying a prayer to a generic deity? They mean God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and the kid sitting next to them means Allah. You really want your kid given the impression, the distinct impression, in public school that little Abdul and little Sally are actually praying to the same God, using the same prayer? Is this what you want? Because that's what you'd get. And that's why I would object to prayer in school. It confuses gods. It is bound to confuse gods unless you somehow picture a classroom where you have no little Jewish children, you have no little Muslim children, you have no little Zoroastrian children, you have no little Hindu children. If you're willing to ban the Muslims, the Jews, the Hindus, and everyone else who isn't a Christian from the classroom, and have nothing but little bright, shining Christian faces looking at you, I guess you could probably pull off a distinctly Christian prayer, or even the generic prayer, if everyone thought they were praying to the true God. Putting prayer back in school would just be inviting bona fide confusion of faiths, and we've already got enough of that coming from the church. Robert calls from his car.
Yes, thank you. I don't see why prayer is the issue ever. There's not a greater issue here. Why would any Christian want to support, have a state school or whatever, that in its very control of reality is a secular humanist institution? It's either Christian teaching or not Christian teaching. Why would anybody support something that is not Christian in its control of reality?
I don't know. It actually makes my point for me. In the public schools, if the teacher were to lead a prayer, what if that teacher were a Buddhist? Come on, kids, let's all pray. And his manner of prayer is, as we'll hear in a few minutes here in Audio Open Lines, a meditative chant. Not to Buddha, but really to the deity within. Hey, that's how Buddhists pray. Look, I know that in the last 30 years, the big bugaboo among Christians has been the encroachment of secular humanism. I'd like someone to define that for me, by the way. It's secular humanism. It's coming to get us. It's coming to get your children. You know what's more dangerous than secular humanism? Religious pluralism, where everybody worships their own God and they all agree it's the same God. All paths lead in the same direction. That's far more dangerous, far more corrosive to the Christian faith than someone who just stands up and says, I don't believe in God, I'm purely a secularist. I think many Christians are going to get caught with their pants down on this one. I just can't see it any other way. They're going to be worried about the boogeyman of secular humanism and locking the front door to keep the secular humanist boogeyman out, while in the back door comes religious pluralism, where everybody prays to their own God and they all tacitly agree it's the same God. Far more dangerous. Jonathan writes from New Jersey via email, I'm not so certain that any of the speakers represent me. He's talking about the panel discussion, but what I find fascinating is the thing which they all unanimously agree on, probably without realizing it, and that is that we all have a, quote, right to our beliefs, and that a government which universally protects that right can somehow be established on this earth. As a Christian, I find that somewhat ironic, that according to Scripture, I actually don't have a right to worship the true God. In fact, so far is freedom of belief removed from my nature that it is only by grace that I have any ability to practice my faith. But beyond that, where is it written that all men have a right of freedom of religion? What kind of a religious ideal is that? It is a religious ideal. You're right, Jonathan. Whose religion came up with that notion? A notion which assumes that religion is indeed the quietism that the Episcopalian lawyer is advocating. I guess what I'm trying to say, writes Jonathan, until Christians start recognizing that the First Amendment is a religious statement that is in practice quite contradictory to a holistic Christian worldview, we will always have trouble, effectively speaking, to the religious public square of a secular, civic, pagan America. You've touched on something very important here, and it goes with the last caller. The problem, the danger, is not secular humanism. It is pan-religious paganism. America is not in danger of becoming an atheistic, secular, humanist country. America is in danger of becoming a pagan country. Not in danger. It is a pagan country. Walk into any evangelical church today on a Sunday morning. Listen to the songs. Tell me if you can honestly determine what God they're actually singing to. And since they believe that their worship is to somehow give God an emotional boost, flatter him a little bit, it's a very pagan notion of worship. Walk in there and see if you can find any reference to the God of Scripture, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Oh, it'll be God, Lord, big guy upstairs. Who knows who that is? And I ask that question honestly. Who knows who that is? Okay, I didn't finish with the email. You still have it there? Jonathan finishes up. He says, I guess what I'm trying to say is that until Christians start recognizing that the First Amendment is a religious statement that in practice is quite contradictory to a holistic Christian worldview, we'll always have trouble. And then he says, the First Amendment is a religious statement. I like it. It protects me. But it's not a universal truth. And it is by assuming that it is a universal truth that arguments like this one have a foundation for disagreement. Did any of this make sense? Yeah, some of it made sense. Thank you, Jonathan. Thanks for taking the time to write. How do they type so fast? I do not know. I couldn't compose something like that. Sure, isn't the First Amendment a religious statement? That the government should not in any way pass laws that would impede or hinder the practice, the free exercise of religion? There is a philosophical basis for that, maybe even a religious basis for that, and that is religion ought to be freely exercised. You know, you're stuck with it. Paul calls from his car. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Todd. I was going to make a quick point, something that I heard in this panel discussion that I hear all the time, and if I'm not mistaken, it was Greg Kokel sometime back on this program that was talking about same-sex marriage, and he's made the point, you know, it's better off not to use the term gay marriage, but same-sex marriage, because that's really the issue. And there's a certain irony when they say we want the same rights as everyone else, when actually they have the exact same rights that everyone else does. They have the right to marry a person of the opposite sex, in which they might respond, well, I don't desire to. I desire to marry my same-sex partner. But then the problem with that is that's the beginning and the end of the argument. It goes no deeper. I desire to do X, Y, and Z, therefore the government should sanction it, shall allow it. And in another context, they certainly wouldn't make that kind of argument because it's ridiculous.
Thank you very much, Paul. You are a good example of how intelligent our audience here is at issues, et cetera. There is a world of difference between saying everyone ought to be able to exercise the same set of rights and what is often asserted under the guise of that, which is everyone ought to have a right to do whatever they want to do. You cannot have a society if everyone has a right to do whatever they want to do. That's called lawlessness. And I don't mean that in a religious sense. I mean that in a purely legal sense. You would not be able to write a law if everyone had the right to do whatever they wanted to do. No, in a society of laws and not of men, we recognize a set of rights that everyone exercises equally. And even then, we put some strictures on them. When was the last time you saw a three-year-old driving a Mack truck? You've never seen it? There's a good reason for that. Three-year-olds aren't safe behind the wheel of a Mack truck, are they? No, we wait until they grow up. Three-year-olds don't have the right to drive yet. Because we recognize that if they did, and there are a lot of three-year-olds who'd love to get behind the wheel of a Mack truck, if they did, many of us would die. Eric in Olathe, Kansas writes this, Pastor, it sounds like Christians and non-Christians spend a lot of time talking past each other. The things of heaven are foolishness to unbelievers, and the high priorities of unbelievers are foolish to the regenerated man. Is there a point where the Christian ceases to argue and simply proclaims the truth and refuses to wrestle in the mud? Not literally, he says. Thank you, Eric. I don't know if it is talking past each other. And I don't think that the Christian panel discussion, I don't think they were expressing anything there that were the high-minded truths hidden from natural man or from his reason. They were simply saying, how far, where do society and religion overlap? You know what the answer eventually is in each and every case? Even for the atheist who has his own religion, his own creed, which is, there is no God, I believe in no God. That's the atheist's creed. Even for the atheist, there is complete and total overlap of one's religion and one's involvement in society. Complete and total. If we were all honest and said, yes, what I believe is a complete interpenetration of my religion with my involvement in society, that I can't compartmentalize one piece of my life from being a Christian. Ah, the brilliance of Luther's two-kingdom theology, which is not two different rooms which a Christian can go into and come out of, but in fact, two realms that the Christian occupies simultaneously all the time. What was Luther saying in that two-kingdom theology? He was saying, you are always a Christian everywhere. Complete overlap. Mark calls from St. Louis. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, Pastor Wilkin. I hope you include me in that intelligent listener category.
Well, let's see.
Okay. On the right to pray, it sounds to me like most of the time people are talking about like I'm being forced to follow a particular, maybe a teacher or leader, and then whoever their God is. But I've heard the story of like the little kindergartner who wants to bow their head and say a prayer, and it being a Christian, but regardless, like at the lunch table, and the teacher comes up and says, you can't do that. They seem to like to pick on Christians. So that to me is, that's against my freedom of speech, I think it is. As a individual, I should have the right to be able to pray a silent prayer or whatever prayer I want to pray to,
now,
or whoever I want to pray to.
Where did you hear this story? I'm just interested in the source.
I'm thinking it was out east, but I mean, it's been a while. I read it before. I was interested in the prayer in school and so forth, and yeah, I've got a poster that says, you think prayer is being disallowed in schools? Wait till there's exams.
Well, that's a good point. I like that one, too. Thank you,
yeah.
Mark. Well, okay. First of all, beware of the stories you hear. There are stories like this, by the way. Now, I'm no expert on the legal issues here, but I will say, as far as I've been able to discern from many conversations on school prayer, there is no law against a kid praying privately in school. What was actually banned was, as our first caller pointed out, school-sponsored, school-enforced moments of prayer. That's what was banned. Now, if a kindergartner is trying to say grace before they eat their sack lunch and the teacher says, you can't do that, it's against the law, guess who's wrong? The teacher is wrong. She's not even on firm legal grounds. When we come back, more of the Today Show feature on Eastern religions.
Priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, etc. Larry Rast, Arthur Just, Carl Fakincher, Kurt Marquardt, Peter Scare, Cameron McKenzie.
You probably recognize these names as regular guests on Issues, etc. But what else do they have in common? Well, they're all members of the Christ-centered, cross-focused faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Dean Wenthe, Walter A. Meyer II, David Scare, Dan Gard, Charles Geeshan, Bill Weinrich.
Have you ever considered the pastoral ministry? Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call them 1-800-481-2155. Preparing Christ-centered, cross-focused pastors for the 21st century. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
John Pless, Hal Senkbeil, Richard Muller, Roland Ziegler.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. A mixed decision from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in an abortion-related case, upholding Ohio's law that says women seeking an abortion must be counseled about the procedure, but striking down its law keeping parents informed about their minor daughter's abortion. Steve Jordahl reports the decision is the inevitable result of inconsistent rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Unlike the Sixth Circuit decision, the people of Ohio have consistently supported common sense restrictions on abortions. Jay Johansson is with Pregnant Pause Ohio.
Informed consent and parental notice have always been overwhelmingly popular.
Circuit Judge R. Guy Cole ruled requiring parents to be involved in their daughter's decision to get an abortion is an undue burden. Johansson says that logic is flawed.
If you said, because some number of parents will be abusive if their kids fail a test, therefore, parents shouldn't be allowed to see their children's school records. You know, we'd say that was ridiculous.
David Miller of Citizens for Community Values says some judges will rubber stamp the girl's request.
The girl only has to shop around so long in order to find a judge that would agree with her.
This decision is the latest in a long line of confusing and conflicting decisions about abortion handed down by U.S. Circuit Courts of Appeal. Alliance Defense Fund attorney Dale Schoengert says it's because of a lack of clarity from the Supreme Court.
The undue burden test, that's the test that the Sixth Circuit applied. It's the main test that the Supreme Court has laid down, or the most current test anyway. That test is a mess.
He says there's a chance the Roberts Court could clarify some abortion issues with its upcoming partial birth abortion decision. It's their first substantive abortion-related case. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
The Sixth Circuit upheld Ohio's requirement that women seeking an abortion be given medically accurate information about the baby they're carrying. Ohio has what many consider to be the nation's strongest informed consent law. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Here's a happy AM 850 KFUL salute to our day sponsor on this Wednesday, November 15th, 2006, a day sponsor who has chosen to remain anonymous. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in honor of a very special lady, Shirley Carr, on her birthday. Shirley has been instrumental in helping bring others to Christ. Happy birthday, Shirley. And once again, we say thank you to our anonymous AM 850 KFUO day sponsor. You can read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, titled The Great Jesus Debates, on our website, issuesetc.org. It's a book about the battle in the early church over the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Great Jesus Debates is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Great Jesus Debates costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. That title again, The Great Jesus Debates.
Mahakaruniko Natho Hitaya Sattvapaninam Puretava Paramisam.
I think they're praying in school. Is that what's happening?
Yeah.
Hey, you can go to some places where the teacher is a Buddhist, where you have a few Buddhists in the class. It could sound like this. Who knows? Actually, that's intended to introduce the next subject during Audio Open Lines, which is the Today Show took up the issue of Eastern religions. Interestingly enough, I want you to listen carefully to this. Oh, I don't know if it made it in the audio, but near the end of one of these pieces on the Eastern religions, the reporter in Hong Kong says, look, these religions are very complicated, very complex, very ancient, and we've kind of simplified them. So apologies to all the religious scholars out there who wanted a more thorough treatment of Buddhism and Hinduism. No such apology, by the way, for the oversimplistic and kind of goofy presentation they made of Christianity yesterday. They didn't have any caveat at the end. Now, Christianity is a serious religion. And there are people who actually take it more seriously than guys like Rick Warren or whoever else they had there. And maybe we haven't fairly represented it. No, no such apology. But when it comes to the Eastern religions, it's all reverence and awe. No disclaimer on the way that they... I don't even know what they were doing with Judaism. I think they intended it as a comedy bit, and I'm surprised it even made it on the air. There were more comedians than rabbis commenting on the Jewish view of the afterlife when the Today Show took it up late last week. But they're doing a series called Mysteries of Faith, and in order to be inclusive of at least all the respectable faiths, they had to deal with the Eastern religions. They deal mostly with Buddhism, a little bit with Hinduism. I want you to listen to this, and I want your reaction as well. One thing we need to bear in mind here, and that is that the influence of Eastern religions in the West has been on the rise, and it is yet to wane. The influence of Eastern religions in the West is profound. It comes in many and various ways. I've even heard one, I don't even remember who it was, someone very smart, say that if you actually examine the basic beliefs of American civil religion in the beginning of the 21st century, not back in the early days of our country, but if you look at American civil religion, that is, that Benjamin Franklin, a religion we can all agree on, if you look at the tenets of it, what people actually believe in the 21st century as part of American civil religion, it is closest not to Christianity or to any Judeo-Christian thing. It is closest to Buddhism in what people actually believe. But let's hear what the Buddhists believe in particular about the afterlife from this morning's Today Show.
This morning in our special series, The Mystery of Faith, we're focusing on the growing importance of Eastern religions on the world stage. Over the last several days, we've looked at Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, all relatively well known in this part of the world. But there are billions of people in Asia who practice different faiths. NBC's Campbell Brown is in Hong Kong this morning with more. Campbell, good morning.
Good morning to you, Lester. And because of the time change, we're about 13 hours ahead of New York. You can't right now see the lush valleys and the mountaintops around me, but you can see this. Check it out. It is one of the world's largest Buddha statues. It is about the height of a 10-story building. And we have come here to talk about two religions, Buddhism and Hinduism. Hinduism originated in Pakistan over 3,000 years ago. It swept through India and now has over a billion followers. Buddha was born some 2,500 years ago. His teachings spread across the Asian continent, and Buddhism now has about 375 million followers. So many people, and yet to so many Americans, these traditions seem a world away.
They are rising societies with exploding economies. Among them, India, China, Thailand, and Taiwan. Combined, their populations exceed 2 billion. Trade between Asia and the U.S. is already over $400 billion a year and rising. At the root of these societies are two faiths shrouded in mystery, Buddhism and Hinduism. To the West, they are enigmatic religions with ornate temples and shrines where the faithful worship mystical-looking gods. For Buddhists, faith is not based on institutionalized religion. Instead, it's a personal journey, where believers don't seek salvation through an omnipotent God, but rather where individuals are divine within themselves and responsible for their own fate.
At the heart of Buddha's 2,500-year-old teachings, he's guiding followers on a journey to enlightenment. Today, those same principles endure, while believers seek a balance between ancient faith and a new world.
At this Buddhist kindergarten in Hong Kong, their lessons taught at an early age.
Whether young or old, you have to be at peace within yourself.
Everybody is a Buddha, but they just don't see it.
To reach their own divinity, Buddhists rely in large part on meditation and chanting and doing good in this life.
We'll pick it up here there in just a moment. They're doing a treatment of Buddhism and Hinduism in general, and then the next piece we'll play for you has to do with the Buddhist view of the afterlife. This is, as you can already see, a religion that is of an entirely different caliber than what we're accustomed to in the Western world, but it's becoming increasingly familiar because its influence is growing. But it's not that different, if you think about it, from most people's popular concept of what it means to be spiritual. And that's why it is so appealing to Americans. Most Americans think in spiritual terms like Buddhists. Even the Christian ones, they do. They think, look, the real spiritual journey is within. It's really about me improving me, digging down deep and finding that inner resource somewhere inside me that I know God must have put there for some reason, and then fanning it into flame and building it up, and it only takes a spark. There's a reason why Pass It On was the most popular campfire song ever. It beautifully expresses this quasi-Buddhist spirituality. Buddha, so many thousands of years ago, was a Hindu. He decided to break with Hindu tradition and he decided to deny that there was a God at all. And he realized that the God was within. And so he went looking for him. And lo and behold, you often find what you're looking for. If you go looking for a God inside you, within you, guess what? Look hard enough, you'll find one. Now, it won't be the true God, but you'll find one. You'll find something in there to worship, to revere, to bow down to. But how much of American spirituality, in quotation, spirituality, is just exactly that? They won't come out and say, oh, we all have a spark of the divine, we're all potentially Buddha, we just don't know it. But they'll say, look, if it's going to be, it's up to me. And the answers lie within. Dig deep. Joel Osteen is filling a stadium with that stuff every week. Now, in contrast, Christianity does not find the answer within, but without, outside oneself. It does not go looking for God in here, but goes looking for God where he has promised to be found, in his Son, Jesus Christ. And all of the assurance and all of the genuine comfort of Christianity is not found in me, but in Christ, outside of me. I don't go look, as a Christian, I don't go looking for inner peace. There is no peace within. I don't go looking for inner tranquility. There is no tranquility within. As a Christian, I look for my peace outside myself. Tranquility, rest, contentment, assurance, confidence, outside myself. In Jesus Christ. Now, to many of the Christians listening, that might sound very odd. Wow, I've never heard Christianity described that way. I always thought that I went looking for Jesus in my heart. Ergo, the popularity of Christians thinking about Jesus as the little man who takes up residence somewhere in their chest. And then either lives there happily or unhappily, but he's in there and I ain't letting him out. Rather than the Jesus in your heart, how about the Jesus on the cross? You can react to this morning's Today Show feature on Eastern religions. We're about halfway through. I want to hear you and your reactions. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
A common misconception is that Buddhism is a religion of renunciation. However, only a small number of Buddhists, primarily monks and nuns, renounce worldly goods for a life of poverty. Instead, throughout Asia, Buddhist-based beliefs and big business go hand in hand. And because of karma, the concept that you reap what you sow, there's no conflict between success in business and Buddhist faith.
If you have success in your business, it's an indicator that you must have done something very good in your past life.
2,000 miles away, in India, home to 1 billion Hindus and the world's second fastest growing economy, centuries-old tradition and ritual live side by side with an explosion of high-tech and information technology.
You have to be born Hindu to be Hindu.
As with Buddhism, despite the strength in numbers, Hindus do not seek to propagate. The biggest misconception, that Hindus believe in more than one God.
The God is fundamentally one, and all Hindus believe that there is only one God.
While the images of multiple deities, up to 330 million gods and goddesses, can be perplexing, they are in fact all expressions of one God, seen through different interpretations.
The most important aspect of Hinduism is the reincarnation. That means you are living this life according to your karma.
But don't, they say, judge their success by Western standards.
Success is your mental attitude. If something you have, even a little, and you are satisfied, that means your life is successful.
It's a message echoed by Hindus and Buddhists alike, from a region of emerging economic force, leaning on thousands of years of traditions and beliefs.
All right, there's the story on Eastern religions. In a few minutes, we'll get to the focus on the Buddhist view of the afterlife, which is quite fascinating. Quite untrue, but quite fascinating nonetheless. I find it fascinating for more than one reason. I'm fascinated by the study of other religions, but also how much we find these very ideas reflected in pop American Christianity. Christians who wouldn't even know Buddhism if it came up and bit them on the backside. But if you compare belief for belief, they may be as much Buddhist as they are Christian. This whole idea of karma, they wouldn't call it karma. But I've mentioned before that there is such a thing as Christian karma. Christians who believe that, hey, look, what goes around comes around. And if I want God to do me a good turn, I do him a good turn. Or I do my neighbor a good turn. And it all kind of evens out in the end. You know, they have a karmic wheel. They just don't call it the karmic wheel. It's Audio Open Lines this Wednesday, November the 15th. Our in-studio email address, issues, etc@kfuo.org. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. How often have you heard Christians say something like, Jesus came to show us the way? Or Jesus came to show us how to get to God? Those are Buddhist notions. That's what Buddha did. Buddha came to show us the path. Jesus came and said, I am the path. Buddha came to show you which way to walk. Jesus came to say, I am the way, and I have walked it for you in your place, taking your sin all the way to the cross. Is your Jesus just Buddha with a beard? Think about it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. Already read that. There we go. Steve in St. Louis. What does Buddhism and Evangelical American Christianity have in common? Both believe that the individual is responsible for their own fate. The Evangelical calls it my decision to follow Christ. Good point, Steve. Another common feature is when they ask, how's your walk with Christ? The assumption is that we are doing the walking with Christ. Thank you, Steve. Yet when Jesus says, I am the way, the word he actually uses there is road or path. When Jesus says, I am the way, he doesn't mean I've come to show you the way. He didn't come down from heaven with a road map. Or a process, or a flowchart. He came down from heaven with a body designed for one thing, bearing sins and dying at the cross. He didn't come to show you the way, he came to be the way. There's a huge difference. Now to the question from today's show this morning. If you're a Buddhist, how do you get to heaven, and what is the afterlife?
This morning, more of our series, How Do You Get to Heaven? Buddhism is the world's fourth largest religion with about 376 million followers, but most of us here in the West are mystified by the Buddhist concept of heaven. NBC's Campbell Brown is in Hong Kong with more, and good morning again, Campbell.
Good morning again to you, Lester. These are ideas that are so foreign to so many Americans and yet so prevalent here, the idea of reincarnation and cycles of life in Hinduism and the heaven on earth that Buddhists are trying to find.
There are many heavens in the Buddha's faith.
Heaven in Buddhism is actually a state of mind.
You don't have to die or anything to get to heaven because...
It's more about becoming enlightened.
For many Westerners raised on God-centered religions, a Buddhist meditation might look like a prayer service. In fact, Buddhists are not praying to Buddha. They are focusing their minds to find the path to Buddha's greatest discovery, heaven on earth.
The ultimate destination is to be right here in an enlightened way, to become a Buddha.
Buddhists believe that Buddha was an ordinary human being, born in 563 BC, who discovered the path to heaven through intense meditation and intellectual devotion, then spent the last 45 years of his life trying to show others how to follow the same path. Buddha was raised as a Hindu and shared some of the same views on the cycle of birth, life, death, and rebirth known as samsara. Hindus and Buddhists believe death is not the end, but rather the beginning of your journey towards reincarnation.
That is why death is a natural culmination of a fulfilled life and not a catastrophe or a calamity.
The Buddhist Wheel of Life illustrates the many possible destinations in the afterlife. Where you go and how long you take to be reborn depends on your karma. Positive actions and deeds during your lifetime will help you get to the pleasant and enlightening realms of heaven until your next incarnation. If you have built up a lot of bad karma by harming others, you end up in one of the hellish realms, subjected to pain and suffering until your next chance at another life on earth.
And that is how your moral behavior in life very much determines your destiny after death.
You are afraid of doing the wrong thing because you know it has a repercussion.
I wonder, you know, these words from the Today Show feature are coming from Buddhists who are just being quite honest about their religion. The religion is, and more or less eternal, for most of us, eternal cycle of lives lived on the karmic wheel. And think of it just like that. It's a Ferris wheel. You put something on it and send it spinning. That something that you sent spinning eventually comes right back around. But think about the sentiments expressed there by those Buddhists. It's not that big of a leap to imagine Christians saying the same thing, unfortunately. The woman said, you live in fear of doing the wrong thing because you know it has repercussions. There are Christians who live their lives on pins and needles. They do not believe in salvation. Although they call it that, what they really believe is in probation. Yeah, Jesus saved me and he died for me, but now the rest is up to me. Jesus saved me, but that salvation is only certain pending good behavior. Yeah, you'll go to heaven because of Jesus and how you behaved afterwards. Yes, Jesus did enough to get me saved, but to keep me saved, many Christians believe, I've got to watch myself. I've got to continue to produce good behavior. That's what keeps me saved. It's Buddhism.
For Hindus, the ultimate goal is to reach the highest realm of the heavens known as moksha and never return to earth.
Moksha is liberation. You are in a liberated state with the highest supreme.
This is where Buddhist discovery made a major break from Hinduism. Buddha believed that the ultimate goal should be to find heaven right here on earth. The Lama Ula Nidal teaches a form of Buddhism known as the Diamond Way, a series of meditations and mental coursework designed to help students become Buddhas themselves.
I think the only religion that shows the mirror behind the pictures, the ocean underneath the waves, that this is actually Buddhism.
Imagine a world in which the sun is always obscured by clouds. Think of those clouds as the negative things in your life, like anger, ignorance, and fear. Through meditation and mental training, Buddhists believe you can push away the clouds and see the sun and the real meaning of life for the first time.
If one can experience whatever happens as a gift because one has an unshakable center that one is seeing it from, then, you know, one is a very rich person.
Enno Jacobson and Christina Slade are students of the Lama Nidal. They believe the mental investment they're making now will pay off during their lifetimes and beyond.
Buddhism has definitely affected how I treat other people or also how I see other people.
It doesn't allow me to be a passive participant in my life. You know, I am the captain of my ship. And when you realize that, life gets really interesting.
And these are complex traditions and belief systems, both Buddhism and Hinduism, and we have boiled them down to the very simplest, most basic core here, so we should ask the religious scholars to forgive us. And Lester, we should also point out that many non-Buddhists in the United States obviously incorporate many of the practices of Buddhism, like meditation, into their daily lives. We think of it as a form of relaxation and sometimes forget the religious origins of these practices.
All right, there's the story on the Buddhist afterlife. It's really heaven here on earth. It's really finding enlightenment within. And then when you die, you hope never to return again. You hope that to finally, at long last, get off the karmic Ferris wheel. Finally, at some point. I guess there is a kind of hope in that view of the world. I think most telling, the woman who spoke at the very end of that feature, who the most she could say about her faith was, when you realize that it's really all up to you, when you realize that you're in control of your own destiny, then it makes life very interesting. For the Christian, one of the most fundamental things that the Christian believes is that he's not in control of his own destiny. If left in control of his own destiny, he will bring everything to ruin. He's not capable of controlling his own destiny to any good end. And that our basic problem is that we try to control our own destiny. Thankfully, God has taken our destinies out of our hands even before we were born, even before the foundation of the world. In Christ, He chose us to be the subject of His love and His sacrifice for us at the cross. It's not a destiny that I write every day. It's not a destiny that I say, what will I do with my life today? Because it isn't my life anymore. Is it predetermined? You bet it is. By the one best qualified to set our destinies. And He's done it in a very particular way. Not as some sort of fatalistic God of the universe, but as the God who loves us in Jesus Christ and founded our eternal destiny, not in ourselves or within us, but founded our eternal destiny in His Son as the sacrifice for our sins. When we come back from this break, Hour 3 of Issues, Etc., Pastor Brian Wolfmiller will join us to talk about a related subject, death, life, and resurrection. Stay tuned.
It's not about you. It's about Jesus for you. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Christ-centered programs you hear every day on AM 850 KFUO are made possible by the generous giving of friends like the Reverend Mark and Lana Hawkinson of New Haven, Missouri, Pastor Richard and Lori Moore of St. Louis, and Ron and Mickey Horstman of Fenton. Thank you. Your faithful support of AM 850 KFUO ensures the future of our radio outreach.